to grow and change as you do, but it will give you a stronger sense of direction now. The right climate to live in. What sustains me? That would be people. Make a list of the people who are currently most influential in your life, friends, family, colleagues, employers, mentors, and so on. Be sure to also include anyone you spend a substantial amount of time with. Then scan the list and determine who on the list is larger than you, more skilled, or more talented, farther ahead professionally, more solid in character, or in any other significant way. If the majority of the people are not stretching you, you need to find additional people who will help you change and grow. Number 3. Significant growth will not occur in your life if you are not continually challenged in your environment. Set specific goals for yourself that are beyond your current capabilities. In addition, review your calendar for the upcoming month. Look for the best potential growth opportunity in each week and plan for it by asking yourself questions similar to the ones contained in the chapter. Chapter 7, The Law of Design. To maximize growth, develop strategies. Jim Rohn said, "If you don't design your own life plan, chances are you'll fall into someone else's plan. And guess what they may have planned for you? Not much." What is your favorite time of year? Is it Christmas? Is it when you celebrate your birthday? Or when flowers bloom in the spring? Or your summer vacation? Or when the children go back to school? Or the beginning of football season? Or when the leaves change? When is it? I can tell you mine. It's the week after Christmas. Glancing backward, planning forward. On Christmas Day in the afternoon, after the grandchildren have finished opening all their presents and all the hoopla has died down, I can hardly contain myself, because I know it's time for one of the things I love most every year. I steal off to my study while everyone else is watching TV or napping, and then on my desk, waiting for me, is my appointment calendar from the preceding year and a yellow legal pad. Starting that afternoon and continuing that week up until New Year's Eve, I spend time reviewing my calendar. I review every appointment, meeting, commitment, and activity hour by hour from the previous 365 days, and I evaluate each of them. I look carefully at my speaking engagements and consider what I should do more of, what I should do less of, and what I should eliminate altogether. I look at the growth opportunities I pursued and judge which gave a high return and which didn't. I look at all the meetings and appointments I had and determine which ones I should do more of and which I should eliminate. I consider how much time I spent doing things that I should have delegated to someone else. I also look at what I delegated and reconsider whether I should pick anything back up or delegate it to someone different. I evaluate whether I spent enough time with my family. I also make a list of all the things Margaret and I did together that year, and I take her out to dinner one night so we can reminisce and enjoy them once again. That's a romantic evening that always ends well. I try to account for every waking hour I had the previous year. And what's the value of that? It helps me to develop strategies for the coming year. Because I do this every year and have for decades, I become more focused, strategic, and effective every year. Even if I have a difficult time or relatively unproductive year compared to what I desired, it's never a loss, because I learn from it and improve upon it in the coming year. There's no substitute for being strategic. To maximize growth, you must develop strategies. That's the law of design. Life lessons. Most people allow their lives to simply happen to them. They float along. They wait. They react. And by the time a large portion of their life is behind them, they realize they should have been more proactive and strategic. I hope that hasn't been true for you. If it has, then I want to encourage you to develop a stronger sense of urgency and a pro-strategic mindset. As you plan and develop strategies for your life and for your growth, I want to share with you 4 things that I learned that helped me in the process. Number 1, life is very simple, but keeping it that way is very difficult. Despite what others might say, I believe life is pretty simple. It's a matter of knowing your values, making some key decisions based on those values, and then managing those decisions on a day-to-day basis. That's pretty straightforward. And at least in theory, the longer we live and the more we learn, the more experience and the more knowledge we acquire, that should make life even simpler. But life has a way of becoming complicated, and it is only through great effort that we can keep it simple. A few years ago, I attended a conference on global strategies for leaders. While we were there, we were divided into groups for some strategic thinking time. I was fortunate to be placed with Neil Cole. Although I did not know him prior to that day, I became impressed very quickly during our discussion time by his ability to design simple, effective strategies. During a break, I asked Neil for advice for designing the strategy to develop leaders globally. He replied, "The secret is found in simplicity." He then shared with me the following three questions that he said would be key to making such a strategy work. Number one, can it be received personally? A profound implication. It must be internalized and transform the soul of the leader. Can it be repeated easily? Simple application. It must be passed on after only a brief encounter. Can it be transferred strategically? A universal communication. It must be passed on globally to all cultural context. My encounter with Neil made a strong impression on me. I later used those questions at Equip as we developed our Million Leader Mandate strategy to train 1 million leaders worldwide. I also came away from that conversation with a determination to design my life as simply as possible by discovering and developing systems for my success. Those systems helped me fight the battle against complexity in my life every day. I believe they can help you too. Just remember, as you develop strategies for growth, to keep them personal, repeatable, and transferable. A beautifully conceived strategy does you no good if you can't use it. Number two, designing your life is more important than designing your career. Oscar-winning actress Reese Witherspoon says, "Many people worry so much about managing their careers, but rarely spend half that much energy managing their lives. I want to make my life, not just my job, the best it can be. The rest will work itself out." I think Witherspoon's advice is partially correct. If you plan your life well, then your career will work itself out. The problem is that most people don't spend very much time planning their careers either. They spend more time planning for Christmas or their vacation. Why? Because people focus on what they think will give them the greatest return. If you don't believe that you can succeed in your life in the long term, you're not very likely to give it the planning attention that it deserves. Planning your life is about finding yourself, knowing who you are, and then customizing a design for your growth. Once you draw the blueprint for your life, then you can apply it to your career. Number three, life is not a dress rehearsal. As you may have guessed by now, I'm a longtime reader of Charles Schulz's comic strip Peanuts. Schulz captured the feelings of many people in a strip in which Charlie Brown says to Linus, "Life is just too much for me. I've been confused from the day I was born. I think the whole trouble is that we're thrown into life too fast. We're not really prepared." Linus responds, "What did you want? A chance to warm up first?" There is no warm up for life, no dress rehearsal, yet that's the way many people seem to be treating it. Each of us goes on stage cold with no preparation, and we have to figure it out as we go along. That can be messy. We fail, we make mistakes, but we still need to give it our best from the very start. Regret over not being proactive enough is a common theme among people looking back on their lives. In his book Aspire, Kevin Hall tells about a trip he made with a group of Boy Scouts and his desire to inspire them to set bold goals for themselves. He did that by telling them about a study of retired successful executives conducted by Gerald Bell, a noted behavioral scientist. Hall writes, "I told them what those 70-year-old executives answered when Dr. Bell asked them what they would do differently if they could live their lives over again. Their response, an answer that ranked far ahead of any others, was this. I should have taken charge of my life and set my goals earlier. Life isn't practice. It's the real thing. I shared the rest of the survey answers with the scouts. Number 2, I would have taken better care of my health. Number 3, I would have managed my money better. Number 4, I would have spent more time with my family. Number 5, I would have spent more time on personal development. Number 6, I would have had more fun. Number 7, I would have planned my career better. 8, I would have given more back. We don't get a rehearsal for life. We have to do the best we can in the moment. But we can learn from others who have gone before us, people like the executives that Bell studied. They should inspire us to plan as best we can, and then give our all. Comedian Fred Allen once said, "You only live once, but if you work it right, once is enough." Number 4. In planning your life, multiply everything by 2. My outlook on life is primarily optimistic, and as a result, my expectations for myself and others tend to be rather unrealistic. Over the course of time, I've learned that the important things in life usually take longer than we expect and cost more than we anticipate. That is especially true when it comes to personal growth. So what do I do to compensate? I multiply by 2. If I think something will take me an hour to do, I plan for double to stay out of trouble. If I think a project will take a week to accomplish, I allot 2. If I think a goal will require $1,000 to fund, I set aside $2,000. 2 isn't a magic number. It just seems to work for me. I found that multiplying everything by 2 infuses realism into my optimism. I'm aware that I'm an especially impatient person, but I think all people naturally desire for things to come to them quickly and easily, including personal growth. The secret isn't really to want more or want it faster. It's to put more time and attention into what you have and what you can do now. Give 3 times the effort and energy to growing yourself, and allow yourself to grow slowly and with deep roots. Remember that a squash vine or a tomato plant grows in a matter of weeks, produces for several days or weeks, and then dies when the first frost comes. In comparison, a tree grows slowly over years, decades, or even centuries. It produces fruit for decades, and if healthy, it stands up to frost, storms, and drought. As you develop strategies for growth, give yourself the time and resources you need. Whatever amounts seem reasonable to you, multiply them by 2. That practice will help you to keep from becoming discouraged and giving up too soon. To develop strategies, depend on systems. Most accomplishments in life come more easily if you approach them strategically. Rarely does a haphazard approach to anything succeed. And even the few times a non-strategic approach to achievement comes to fruition, it's not repeatable. So how do you accomplish something strategically on a consistent basis? By creating and using systems. One of the greatest secrets to my personal growth and high productivity is that I use systems for everything. I have a system for growing personally and gleaning information. I try to read 4 books every month. I pick 2 that I can go through fairly quickly and 2 that I really want to dig into. I also listen to CDs in my car. When I was preaching a weekly sermon as a pastor, I used to listen to 5 every week. I'd give a CD 5 minutes. If it was bad, I'd stop listening. If it was good, I'd listen to the whole thing. If it was great, I'd stop listening after 5 minutes and set the CD aside to have it transcribed so that I could read every word. I have a system for capturing and filing all the good stories, quotes, and articles that I read. If I find an article I like, I rip it out of the magazine or journal, write at the top the topic it should be filed under, and set it aside for my assistant to put it in my files. As I read a book, when I find a quote or a story that I like, I mark the page, write the topic I want it filed under, and write the page number where it can be found on the inside front cover of the book. When I'm done reading the book, I give it to my assistant, and she photocopies the quotes or types them up and puts them into my quote files. This practice has changed my life. Most people I know who take the time to grow personally don't take the time to capture the best thoughts and ideas they come across. They spend hours or days looking for a story they once read or a quote they can't quite recall. "Didn't I read something about that recently?" they wonder. Now, which book was that in? Maybe they are able to find it, maybe not. Do you know how much time it takes me to find something I read and want to recall? 2 minutes or less. Usually I can walk over to my desk and put my hand on it in under a minute. If I can't recall what topic I found it under and have to check 2 or 3 topics, it might take me as long as 5 minutes. I have a system for thinking. I keep about a dozen quotes or ideas in the Notes app on my iPhone, which I have with me all the time. I refer to them throughout the day so they can really sink into my mind and heart. When I swim laps every day, I choose 1 or 2 thoughts, or sometimes a couple of prayer items, to roll over in my mind while I swim. And I also have my thinking chair. If I wake up in the middle of the night, which is a fairly common occurrence, I slip down into my office with a legal pad to think and write. I have a system for writing. Before I take a major trip, which can last up to 2 or 3 weeks, I spend a day or longer preparing what I need to write. I create a notebook with raw material. If the outline for the book has 15 chapters, I put together a binder with 15 numbered tabs. If I already have some thoughts about a particular chapter, I three-hole punch it and put it behind that tab. I also go into my quote and article files and photocopy any material I think I might want to use for that chapter. I three-hole punch those pages and put them behind that tab. If I've written a lesson on that subject, I copy it, three-hole punch it, and put it behind the tab. By the time I'm done, I've got an entire binder of material hand-picked for every chapter. With that, a legal pad, tape, and a pen, I'm ready to write whether I'm on the plane, in a hotel room, or staying at a relative's house. I have a system for planning my days. I look at my calendar 6 weeks out so I know what's coming and can plan my work. And every morning, I review my schedule for the day and ask myself, what is the main event? I make sure I know the most important thing I must win that day, no matter what else happens. I even have systems for waiting in lines and other mundane activities. For example, if I'm at a ball game with friends and we go to a concession stand to get food, if there are 3 lines, I stand in one and ask friends to stand in the other 2. When one of us gets to the counter first, then we all go to that person and we place our orders together. That way we save time. Strategies and systems are a way of life for me. Michael Gerber, the author of The E-Myth, says that systems permit ordinary people to achieve extraordinary results predictably. However, without a system, even extraordinary people find it difficult to predictably achieve even ordinary results. I totally agree with that. What is a system? It is a process for predictably achieving a goal based on specific, orderly, repeatable principles and practices. Systems leverage your time, money, and abilities. They are great tools for personal growth. Systems are deliberate, intentional, and practical. They really work, regardless of your profession, talent level, or experience. They improve your performance. A life without any system is a life where the person must face every task and challenge from scratch. What systems include? If you want to make the most of your personal growth by getting the most you can out of every effort and doing it as efficiently as possible, you need to develop systems that work for you. That will be a personal thing, because your systems need to be tailored to you. However, as you strive to create them, keep the following 6 guidelines in mind. Number 1, effective systems take the big picture into account. Stephen Covey observed, "We may be very busy, we may be very efficient, but we will also be truly effective only when we begin with the end in mind." When I started creating systems for my personal growth, they were very targeted. I knew I would be speaking every week of my life. I knew I would be leading people and organizations. As I approached age 30, I realized that I wanted to write books. My efforts had to support and advance my abilities in those areas. People who excel, regardless of their profession, develop systems to help them achieve the big picture. A good example of that was Muhammad Ali's preparation for the Rumble in the Jungle fight against George Foreman on October 30, 1974. It's true that Ali was a great athlete, the greatest according to him, but physically he was no match for Foreman, who was a powerful puncher. Virtually nobody thought he had a chance. Joe Frazier and Ken Norton had beaten Ali previously, and George Foreman had knocked out both of those fighters in the second round. But Ali could see Foreman's weakness, his lack of staying power, and Ali figured out a system that would allow him to overcome the stronger boxer. Ali called it the rope-a-dope. Ali would lean back against the ropes, shielding himself while Foreman pounded away, trying to knock him out. For seven rounds, Foreman threw hundreds of punches and Ali let the storm blow over him. By round eight, Ali could see that Foreman had worn himself out. That's when Ali dropped Foreman with a combination and reclaimed the heavyweight championship of the world. It's not enough to be busy. If you're busy planning, busy reading books, and busy going to conferences, but they aren't targeted on the areas essential to your success, you're not helping yourself. As the saying goes, unhappiness is not knowing what we want and killing ourselves to get it. What is your big picture? In what areas must you grow to achieve your purpose? Author and professor C.S. Lewis said, "Every person is composed of a few themes. What are yours? And what systems can you develop to advance yourself in those areas today and every day?" I had to stop reading books simply for pleasure and read books that would help me in my areas of strength. I also took two speed reading courses to help me improve. What must you do? Number two, effective systems make use of priorities. A system is of limited help to you if it doesn't take into account your priorities. Brian Tracy says, "Perhaps the very best question you can memorize and repeat over and over is, what is the most valuable use of my time right now?" Your answer to that question should shape any system you create for yourself. You should also ask yourself, when is my most valuable time? Because you'll want to always make the most of it. For me, it's the morning. When I recognized that, I stopped scheduling any breakfast meetings. That was 30 years ago. Imagine how much of my prime time would have gotten used up if I'd allowed myself to meet with people, which I'm capable of doing any time, during my prime productivity time. Making that decision for me was pretty easy. Others have been more difficult. I am very opportunity-driven, and I tend to want to do everything. If one is good, four is better. I love saying yes. I have a very hard time saying no. As a result, I get spread too thin. To deal with that, I had to develop a system. I was no longer allowed to answer requests for my time. Instead, requests had to go to a group that would decide whether or not I would accept a speaking engagement or other request. We fondly named them the Hatchet Committee. Why? Because they put the axe to 90% of the requests that came in. It was the only system that I could find that forced me to maintain my priorities when it came to my time. What system do you need to put into place to help you maintain your priorities? And what people do you need to give responsibility and power to so they can help you? Number three, effective systems include measurement. Jack Welch, former CEO of General Electric, asserted, "Strategy is first trying to understand where you sit in today's world, not where you wish you were or where you hoped you would be, but where you are. Then it's trying to understand where you want to be 5 years out. Finally, it's assessing the realistic chances of getting from here to there." What do all three of these actions, knowing where you are, where you want to be, and the chances of getting there, have in common? Measurement. Any kind of progress requires the ability to measure, and for that reason, your systems must include a way to measure your results. When I first moved to Atlanta from San Diego, I was surprised by how congested and difficult traffic was in the area. Road building seemed to run about 10 years behind population growth. I couldn't do anything about the roads, but I was determined to improve my ability to get around. What was my solution? For the first 6 months, I explored alternate routes to my most common destinations, and I tracked the mileage and the time it took me on every route. I discovered 5 different routes to the Atlanta airport, and I knew which one to take based on the time of the day and the different traffic scenarios. I could have been a limo driver. H. James Harrington, former engineer, IBM executive, and performance improvement pioneer, says, "Measurement is the first step that leads to control and eventually to improvement. If you can't measure something, you can't understand it. If you can't understand it, you can't control it. If you can't control it, you can't improve it." Think about it. Where would business people be if they had no way of measuring their profits? Where would sales and marketing people be if they had no idea how many leads turned into sales or how many people responded to advertising? Where would sports teams be if they never knew the score of the game? Measurement is key to improvement. In fact, measurement itself can even create improvement. Researchers who conducted experiments in productivity at the Hawthorne Works plant outside of Chicago in the 1930s discovered that when people knew their work was being measured, their productivity increased. Researchers called this the Hawthorne effect. Measurement makes a difference. It enables you to set goals and evaluate progress, judge results, and diagnose problems. If you want to stimulate your growth progress and evaluate the results, build measurement into your systems. Number 4. Effective systems include application. If you had the most beautiful blueprints in the world for the most spectacular home, what value would they have if there was no action plan to build it? Not much. That's why William Danforth, the founder of Nestle Purina, said, "No plan is worth the paper it's printed on unless it starts you doing something." I've been a fan of Ohio State University football for decades, and for several years while Jim Tressel was head coach of the team, I had the privilege of speaking to the team before the annual game with Michigan, and then watching the game on the sidelines. What a wonderful experience. Once while I was there, I noticed a sign that asked players and coaches one simple question. What are you going to do now? That's a great question for us to ask ourselves every time we go out onto our playing field. What are we going to do? It's not enough just to plan, though planning is important. Both plan and action must go together. The plan creates the track. The action provides the traction. So anytime you have a goal, but you think you won't be able to reach it, don't just adjust the goal, adjust the action steps. People who develop systems that include action steps are almost always more successful than people who don't. Even less talented people with fewer resources accomplish more if they have developed the habit of taking action. That's one of the reasons I developed the habit of asking myself 3 questions every time I learn something new. Where can I use this? When can I use this? And who needs to know this? This has become a discipline in my life, so I always have a bias toward action when I learn anything new. Number 5. Effective systems employ organization. I once saw a sign in a cluttered country store that read, "We've got it if you can find it." That's not much of a help, is it? I mentioned earlier in the chapter that I have a system for filing quotes. Why did I develop it? Because the number one time waster for most people is looking for things that are lost. My choleric personality and the heavy workload of my career prompted me to start developing systems. In the beginning, it was the only way that I could be sure that things got done. And even though as my career developed, I was able to hire an assistant and then additional staff members, I continued to use systems to keep myself and my interaction with my staff and coworkers organized. For example, I touch base with my assistant Linda Eggers at least once a day, every day, 365 days a year. It doesn't matter if I'm at home in Florida or on the road in China. I also have a way of organizing my calendar, or more accurately, asking Linda to organize my calendar. Family activities go on the calendar first. Why? Because they are my highest priority. Everything else has to fit around them. Time has a way of getting away from most people, yet time is what life is made of. Everything we do requires time, yet many people take it for granted. How you spend your time is more important than how you spend your money. Money mistakes can be corrected, but once time has passed, it's gone forever. Being organized gives a sense of power. When you know your purpose and priorities and you have ordered your day, week, or year according to them, you have a clarity of thought that strengthens everything you do. You develop an efficiency that helps you to follow through on everything you do. There are a few things like it. Make sure your systems make you as organized as you can possibly be. Number 6. Effective systems promote consistency. Journalist Sidney J. Harris observed, "An idealist believes the short run doesn't count. A cynic believes the long run doesn't matter. A realist believes that what is done or left undone in the short run determines the long run." In other words, if you want to succeed in the long run, you must learn to be consistent day in and day out, week in and week out, year in and year out. You will never change your life until you change something you do daily. The secret of your success is found in your daily routine. So any system you develop needs to promote consistency, and you must follow it consistently. What does it take to develop consistency? A system and the discipline to follow through. I came across the story of an older gentleman at the funeral of fiery NBA basketball coach Bill Musselman in 2000, who approached Bill's son, Eric, to tell him a story. The gentleman said he was driving down a two-lane highway on the way to Orrville, Ohio, when he saw a boy about 11 years old dribbling a basketball with his right hand along the side of the road. The man said he pulled over and asked the boy, "Where are you going?" Without stopping dribbling, the boy replied, "Orrville." "Do you know Orrville is 10 miles away?" he asked. "Yes." "What are you going to do when you get there?" "Dribble back home with my left hand." The old man looked at Eric and said, "That boy was your father. Now that's what I call creating a system and having the discipline to follow through on it." Despite the dramatic nature of that story of Musselman's efforts to grow as a basketball player, most efforts at consistency are not so exciting. Every now and then I get requests from people who say they want to spend a day with me. I think they would be very disappointed by how boring my average day is. I'm up early and I spend hours at my desk. In the afternoon I exercise and take care of people-related responsibilities. And I usually go to bed by 10 o'clock. It's not exciting, but it is consistent. And it's a system that works for me. One golfer's strategy. I've enjoyed the game of golf for more than 40 years. A few years ago, I came across Harvick Penick's Little Red Book, Lessons and Teachings from a Lifetime in Golf. It contains tips and anecdotes on golf from a head pro who was a golfer and teacher for more than 80 years. The author is Harvey Penick, who fell in love with golf as a boy. He started working as a caddy when he was 8 years old and worked his way up at the Austin Country Club in Austin, Texas. When he was a senior in high school, an influential member of the club offered to get him an appointment to West Point. "No, thank you, sir," was Harvey's reply. "The only thing in life I want to be is a golf pro." Harvey was running the club as a head pro before he reached the age of 20. Harvey's great love was teaching golf. He taught thousands of golfers during his career at the club, which he oversaw as the head pro for 50 years. He also worked as a coach of the golf team at the University of Texas for more than 30 years. Among the pros he taught were Tom Kite, Ben Crenshaw, Mickey Wright, Betsy Rawls, and Kathy Whitworth. Harvey wanted to become the best he could at teaching golf, and to do that, he was very systematic. He treated every student as an individual, whether the person was a first-time golfer, someone with a high handicap who wanted to improve his score, or a tour professional, fine-tuning his game. He never allowed one player to watch him give a lesson to another. He was concerned that observers might try to adopt the coaching to their own games when the advice didn't apply to them. And every time Harvey accepted a new player onto his University of Texas team, he would ask about the teaching methods the student's club pro had used. His strategy was always to keep improving as a teacher. Harvey's son, Tinsley, who became a golf pro in his own right, said, "My dad always said that the day he stopped learning would be the day he stopped teaching. He must have been learning right up to the day he died, because he never stopped teaching." The strategy that made Harvey Penick world famous was his practice of recording observations and practices in a small red scribble text notebook. He began doing it sometime in his 20s. He wanted to record what worked so he could teach it. He did that for more than 60 years. He kept the book locked in his briefcase, and the only person he ever let read it was Tinsley. Harvey's intention was to pass on what he called his Little Red Book to his son when he retired. Instead, Harvey decided he wanted to share his lifetime of wisdom with others. He partnered with Bud Schrake, a sports writer, to publish the book. It became an instant bestseller and has since become the best-selling sports book of all time. Harvey remarked, What made my little red book special was not that what was written in it had never been said before. It was that what it says about golf has stood the test of time, whether it is for beginners, medium players, experts, or children. Anything I say in my book has been tried and tested with success. As you seek to develop strategies to maximize your growth, you should also seek out principles that have stood the test of time. And like Harvey, don't try to simply adopt someone else's practices as your own. Customize them to yourself. Use them to build your strengths and reach your goals. And remember that, as Jim Rohn said, if you go to work on your goals will go to work on you. If you go to work on your plan will go to work on you. Whatever good things we build end up building us. That is the power of the law of design. Applying the law of design to your life. Number one, take some time to assess which areas in your life receive the most of your strategic planning time. Here's a list of areas to get you thinking. Add others that apply to you. Career, faith, family, health, hobby, marriage, personal growth, vacation. Have you been strategic in your approach to designing strategies and systems for your life? If not, why not? If so, where have you placed the most emphasis? Does your past behavior line up with what you say your priorities are? How would you like them to be? Number two, begin developing or refining systems for yourself that will maximize your time and increase your efficiency. Brainstorm a list of areas where you desire to improve, are experiencing a problem, or sensing an opportunity. Try to create a system to help you for each. As you design them, make sure that each takes into account the following. The big picture. Will the system help you reach your big picture goals? Your priorities. Is the system consistent with your values and commitments? Measurement. Does the system give you a tangible way to judge if you've succeeded? Application. Does the system have a built-in bias toward action? Organization. Does the system make better use of your time than what you are doing now? Consistency. Can and will you easily repeat the system on a regular basis? Don't be reluctant to make adjustments to systems you develop, or even abandon them if they don't serve you well. However, you may want to try out any system you develop for at least 3 weeks, the normal time needed to start developing a positive habit, before evaluating its validity. Number three, many people who try to develop strategies for their life and growth make them too complicated. Any system you develop should be simple and straightforward. To test the ones you develop, try this. Explain them to a friend to see if they pass two tests. The first is whether you can explain it clearly. If you can't, it may be too complicated. The second is to see if your friend knows of a better or simpler way of achieving the same goal. Chapter 8, The Law of Pain. Good management of bad experiences leads to great growth. John MacDonald said, "Every problem introduces a person to himself." How do you usually respond to bad experiences? Do you explode in anger? Do you shrink into yourself emotionally? Do you detach yourself from the experience as much as possible? Do you ignore it? John MacDonald once said, "Every problem introduces a person to himself." What an insight! Each time we encounter a painful experience, we get to know ourselves a little better. Pain can stop us dead in our tracks, or it can cause us to make decisions we would like to put off, deal with issues we would rather not face, and make changes that make us feel uncomfortable. Pain prompts us to face who we are and where we are. What we do with that experience defines who we become. Pain unimaginable. Recently, I came across the story of Cheryl McGinnis, someone who lived through about as bad an experience as a person can. One morning in late summer, her husband Tom went off to work before dawn, as he often did, kissing her before he left. A few hours later, Cheryl got up, took her teenage daughter and son to school, and settled into her daily routine. Then she got a phone call from a friend asking if Tom was home. Then another. She knew something was up, but she had no clue what it was. When she pressed for an answer, the friend finally responded, "A plane has been hijacked." It was the morning of September 11, 2001, and Cheryl's husband, Tom, was a pilot for American Airlines. For hours, while Cheryl's house filled with friends, neighbors, other pilots, and people from her church, she was unable to get any answers to her questions. But when a car pulled up to her house carrying the chief pilot of the airline, she learned what happened. American Airlines Flight 11, for which Tom had been the co-pilot, was the first plane that crashed into the World Trade Center. Tom and all the others on the plane were dead. Like most people who survive a terrible tragedy, Cheryl coped as best she could. Some individuals manage negative experiences well, while others struggle. According to experts, in the wake of the World Trade Center attacks, many people suffered from severe stress, post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, general anxiety disorder, and substance abuse disorders. Despite having such a personally tragic connection to the 9/11 attacks, Cheryl did well under the circumstances. In Beauty Beyond the Ashes, a book she published 3 years after the event, she wrote, "As unfair, unreasonable, and impossible as it seems, we still have work to do after a tragedy occurs. We still have roles to fill. We still have responsibilities to family and others. The stuff of life may pause for a while, but it doesn't stop. Fair or not, that is reality." Cheryl fulfilled her role with determination and strength. She planned Tom's funeral and even spoke at it, which was something far out of her comfort zone. She took care of her children. She started running her household as a single parent, and she learned rapidly how to deal with the difficulties of being a widow. For example, for the first Mother's Day she spent alone after the tragedy, she allowed well-meaning friends to talk her into going to an event that they thought would help her. It was a mistake. So as Father's Day approached, she was proactive and arranged the day to make the best of it for herself and for her children. Each new experience became an opportunity for personal growth. Cheryl writes, "I am learning more each day. The circumstances of 9/11 have forced me to examine who I am, to face myself in ways that I never had to before, to ask, what does God want for me? What can I do in Him by His power within me? How will He use me to touch others? I am learning more about myself and about God, and I'm learning it on my own, not through Tom's filter." Cheryl says that she didn't realize until Tom was gone how lazy she had become. Before, she had depended on him to prompt her growth. Now she was taking responsibility for it herself. One of the areas where she grew the most was in public speaking. "Before 9/11, I had never been a public speaker. The very thought of speaking before a large group frightened me. When I spoke at Tom's memorial service, I put aside my fear for that one day, figuring I had been given a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. I didn't expect to speak in public ever again. But people kept asking her to speak, and step by step, she grew as a speaker. She was determined to allow her loss to lead to others' gain. Today, Cheryl's children are growing. She's remarried. Her husband is Doug Hutchins, and she is content with her life." She was asked about the tragedy on its 10th anniversary. "It's a terrible, terrible day that I don't think anybody can ever forget." But she added, "Out of the ashes of September 11, out of the rubble of that day, I can emerge to say that I am stronger today than 10 years ago." That's what can happen when a person manages bad experiences well. That shows you the power of the law of pain. What I know about bad experiences. What separates people who thrive from people who merely survive? I believe it's how they face their problems. That's the reason I wrote Failing Forward. I wanted to help people to deal with problems and mistakes in a way that helped them rather than hurt them. I wanted to teach people how to use bad experiences as stepping stones for success. I've never known anyone who said, "I love problems." But I've known many who have admitted that their greatest gains came in the middle of their pain. Here's what I know about bad experiences. Number one, everyone has them. Life is filled with ups and downs. The problem is that what most of us want is ups and ups. That's not possible. I think it's pretty obvious that nobody gets to escape bad experiences. Perhaps that's one of the reasons my speech, How to Do Good When Things Are So Bad, has been so popular. As the saying goes, some days you're the pigeon, some days you're the statue. We could do everything in our power to avoid negative experiences, but they have a way of finding us. I love the quote, I try to take life one day at a time, but lately several days have attacked me at once. No matter who you are, where you live, what you do, or what your background is, you will have to deal with bad experiences. As television host and author Dennis Holy observed, expecting the world to treat you fairly just because you're a good person is a little like expecting the bull not to charge you because you're a vegetarian. You have to have realistic expectations when it comes to pain and problems. You can't avoid them. Number two, no one likes them. Academy Award-winning actor Dustin Hoffman described what it was like for him and some fellow actors in the early days of their careers when they were struggling. If anyone had told us that we would have been successful, we would have laughed in their face. We were anything but successful actors in those days. I was a waiter, Gene Hackman was a mover, and Robert Duvall worked at a post office. We didn't dream of being rich and famous. We dreamed of finding a job. It was a time of terrible rejection, and we hated being rejected. It got to the point that we used to leave our 8x10s at the door of casting agents, knock and run, just so we wouldn't have to be rejected face to face again. It was so discouraging that I seriously considered quitting and becoming an acting teacher at a university. No one likes it when they're in the middle of a bad experience. It's usually just painful. But if they manage the experience well, then they enjoy talking about it afterward. It becomes a great war story. Number three, few people make bad experiences positive experiences. Life's difficulties do not allow us to stay the same. They move us. The question is, in which direction will we be moved? Forward or backward? When we have bad experiences, do we become better or bitter? Will those experiences limit us or lead us to growth? As Warren G. Lester remarked, success in life comes not from holding a good hand, but in playing a poor hand well. When tough times come, many people don't respond well. Some seem to have the motto that I once saw on a bumper sticker. When the going gets tough, it's time to take a nap. What a shame. Learning the law of pain is essential for anyone who wants to grow. Most successful people will point to the hard times in their lives as key points in their journey of development. If you are dedicated to growth, then you must become committed to managing your bad experiences well. My pain file. Everyone has a pain file. You've got yours, I've got mine. I may not have experienced anything as traumatic as Cheryl McGinnis did, but I've had my share of failures and negative experiences. Here are a few that have become gains in growth over the long run. The pain of inexperience. I expected instant success early in my career, but stumbled often because of my immaturity. I had to learn patience and earn respect and influence from others. The pain of incompetence. I did a lot of counseling early in my career, and I was terrible at it. That forced me to reevaluate my gifting. Only when I started equipping people did I find my strike zone. The pain of disappointment. Margaret and I were scheduled to adopt a son, but then lost him. We were devastated. 6 months later, we adopted our son Joel, who is a great joy in our lives. The pain of conflict. One church I led experienced a split in the congregation, and some of the people left the church. That experience made me dig deeper as a leader. The pain of change. I've already told you about how early in my career I changed organizations. That meant I had to start over. Though difficult, it afforded me many opportunities. The pain of bad health. My heart attack at age 51 was excruciating. It was also an eye-opener. I immediately changed my eating habits and bought into the practice of daily exercise. The pain of hard decisions. Wanting everybody to be happy and making tough decisions were incompatible tasks. I learned that good leadership is disappointing people at a rate that they can stand. The pain of financial loss. A bad investment decision cost us greatly. It wasn't fun selling my assets to cover it. It helped me to be more careful in risk-taking. The pain of relationship losses. Striving to reach my potential has separated me from friends who had no desire to grow. As I developed new friendships, I learned to build relationships with growing people who wanted to take the journey with me. The pain of not being number one. In one job, I followed a wonderful founding pastor who was greatly loved as a leader. For some people, I was never as loved or respected as much as he was. That taught me humility. The pain of traveling. My career has kept me on the road. It taught me to value my family and motivated me to make the most of our time together. The pain of responsibility. Leading organizations and having many people depend on me has required me to think of others' well-being, continually create new content, keep my calendar full, and constantly meet demanding deadlines. This has been very tiring, but it also has taught me a lot about priorities and self-discipline. What have all these painful experiences taught me? To let my discomfort be a catalyst for my development. Growth is the best possible outcome for any negative experience. How to turn your pain into gain. Frank Hughes quipped, "Experience isn't really the best teacher, but it sure does serve as the best excuse for not trying to do the same silly thing again." If you want your bad experiences to keep you not only from doing the same silly things, but to also lead to significant growth, I suggest that you embrace the following five actions. Number one, choose a positive life stance. Life stance is a term used to describe people's overall frame of reference, the set of attitudes, assumptions, and expectations people hold about themselves, other people, and the world in general. It comprises, for instance, people's attitudes toward money, assumptions about their health, and expectations for their children's future. The product of any person's life stance is their overall way of looking at things, whether they tend to be optimistic or pessimistic, cheerful or gloomy, trusting or suspicious, friendly or reserved, brave or timid, generous or stingy, giving or selfish. If you can maintain a positive life stance, you put yourself in the best position to manage bad experiences and turn them into positive growth. Family therapy pioneer and author Virginia Satir observed, "Life is not the way it's supposed to be, it's the way it is. The way you cope with it is what makes the difference. You cannot control much of what happens to you in life. However, you can control your attitude. And you can choose to rise above your circumstances and refuse to allow negative experiences to undermine who you are and what you believe. And you can be resolved to find something positive to learn in the face of tragedy, as Cheryl McGinnis did. I have come to adopt a positive life stance because I believe it gives me the best chance to succeed while putting me in the best position to help others succeed. I came to develop this mindset by way of the following thinking. Life is filled with good and bad. Some of the good and the bad I can't control. That's life. Some of the good and bad will find me. If I have a positive life stance, the good and the bad will become better. If I have a negative life stance, the good and the bad will become worse. Therefore, I choose a positive life stance. To a large degree in life, you get what you expect, not always, but most of the time. So why would I want to expect the worst? Instead, I try to follow the idea expressed by poet John Greenleaf Whittier when he wrote, "No longer forward nor behind I look in hope or fear, but grateful, take the good I find, the best of now and here." If you can do that, you not only make the life you have more livable, you also make life lessons more learnable. Number two, embrace and develop your creativity. There's a story about a chicken farmer whose land was flooded nearly every spring. He didn't want to give up his farm and move, but when the water backed up onto his land and flooded his chicken coops, it was always a struggle to get his chickens to higher ground. Some years he couldn't move fast enough, and hundreds of his chickens drowned. After the worst spring he'd ever experienced and losing his entire flock, he came into the farmhouse and he told his wife, "I've had it. I can't afford to buy another place. I can't sell this one. I don't know what to do." His wife replied, "Buy ducks." The people who make the most of bad experiences are the ones who find creative ways to meet them, like the farmer's wife in the story. They see possibilities within their problems. Author Neil Donald Walsh asserted, "Life begins at the end of your comfort zone." I believe that creativity begins at the end of your comfort zone. When you feel the pain of bad experiences, creativity gives you the opportunity to turn that pain into gain. The secret to doing that is to use the energy that comes from either adrenaline or anger and use it to solve problems and learn lessons. I experienced this many years ago when I was invited by Lloyd Ogilvy to contribute to the Communicator's Commentary, a series of 21 books of biblical commentary on the Old Testament. Lloyd asked me to write the commentary on the book of Deuteronomy, and I agreed. But it didn't take me long to realize I was in way over my head. I'm no Old Testament scholar. Trying to write that book was a terrible experience. 3 different times I went to Lloyd asking to be released from the agreement, and all 3 times he declined, encouraging me to keep working at it. The bad news was that I was failing at the task, and I was miserable about it. The good news is that because he wouldn't take no for an answer, I had to become more creative. I started to interview biblical scholars to gain their perspective, and because my Hebrew wasn't strong enough, I hired Professor William Yarkin to tutor me in Hebrew. Those actions, plus a lot of hard work, enabled me to finish the task. And when all the volumes in the series were published, I asked the other 20 authors to sign copies of theirs. Today that collection sits on the shelf of my library as a treasured possession. When you have a bad experience, instead of letting it discourage you or make you angry, try to find a way to let it prompt your creativity. Number 3, embrace the value of bad experiences. President John F. Kennedy was once asked how he became a war hero. With his customary dry wit, he responded, "It was quite easy. Somebody sunk my boat." It's always easier to see something positive in a negative experience long after it happens. It's difficult to meet the negative experience in the moment with a positive mindset. However, if you can do that, you will always be able to learn something from it. Inventor Charles F. Kettering, who was the head of research at General Motors, said, "You will never stub your toe standing still. The faster you go, the more chance there is of stubbing your toe, but the more chance you have of getting somewhere." In other words, where there is no struggle, there is no progress. Facing difficulties is inevitable. Learning from them is optional. Whether you learn is based on if you understand that difficulties present opportunities to learn and treat them accordingly. Number 4, make good changes after learning from bad experiences. Novelist James Baldwin commented, "Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced." Often it takes a bad experience for us to face the changes we need to make in our lives. I know that was true for me when it came to my health. As I mentioned previously, I experienced a heart attack at age 51. Prior to that, I knew deep down I wasn't eating right or exercising enough. But I'd never had any health problems, so I just plowed ahead as I always had. But the night I had the heart attack, the excruciating pain I felt in my chest, and the belief in that moment that I wasn't going to see my family again finally got my attention. It made me face the fact that I needed to change the way I was living. You could say I had finally reached a teachable moment. And that is the value of the law of pain. It gives us an opportunity to turn our lives around. A bend in the road is not the end of the road unless you fail to make the turn. Most people don't think their way to positive change. They feel their way. In their book, The Heart of Change, Harvard Business Professor John Cotter and Deloitte Consulting Principal Dan Cohen explain, "Changing behavior is less a matter of giving people analysis to influence their thoughts than helping them to see a truth to influence their feelings. Both thinking and feelings are essential, and both are found in successful organizations, but the heart of change is in the emotions. When bad experiences create strong feelings in us, we either face the feelings and try to change, or we try to escape. It's the old fight or flight instinct. We need to train ourselves to fight for positive changes. How do we do that? By remembering that our choices will lead to either the pain of self-discipline or the pain of regret. I'd rather live with the pain of self-discipline and reap the positive rewards than to live with the pain of regret. which is something that can create a deep and continual ache within us. Athlete and author Diana Nyad says, I am willing to put myself through anything, temporary.